Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we will be doing a program that we do every month. It's always on a Friday, and it's a program that's dedicated to talking about personal finance and money management issues. And our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I, and for quite a while now, he's been stopping by on a regular basis to do these shows to answer your questions. And the way it works is this. He starts with making a few comments, and sometimes he talks about the economy. Sometimes he talks about some specific kind of investing subject. And then if you have questions on anything that he has to say here in the beginning part or anything else that has to do with investing money management, I know Dave will do his best to help you out. So with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here once again.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I guess the major questions on almost everyone's mind seem to be, what in the world is going on with our economy? And hey, are we heading into a full-steam recession, or aren't we? And what in the world does all of that mean? So let me see if I can spend just a couple of minutes with our listening audience and maybe accidentally demystify some of this. Well, quite obviously, there is a continuing profusion of bad economic news that bombards us daily. Let me provide you very quickly with just some examples from yesterday's headlines. First, construction of new homes falls 24.8% in 2007, the largest drop in 27 years. That was just one headline. Two, unemployment shoots up to 5%, rising by the largest amount in 1 month since the country was reeling from the 2001 terrorist attacks. Three, the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Board, one of the most respected sources of economic data, announced yesterday dreadful, I quote, dreadful economic numbers, numbers reminiscent of the 2001-2002 recession. And of course, number four, Merrill Lynch and Citicorp report combined fourth quarter write-downs in excess of $22 billion. That's a B with a billion. And investors remain skeptical as they continue to unload stocks. Now, that's just quoting headlines in some of the largest economic periodicals published in the United States. Also, what's especially interesting is the media tone. For example, I remember, David, from my undergraduate days, I think this came from speech communication, that there was a great deal of research going on in a theory called content analysis of the media. And in its simplest terms, as I remember it, and this is very simple terms, content analysis really just simply counted positive and negative words or concepts in newsprint. So I decided to go back to my roots, and I compared the front page stories of Wednesday and Thursday's Wall Street Journal to the journal articles of just 3 months ago. And even, frankly, I was struck by the stark difference in the use of the language, the tone of the language, how much more debilitating, detrimental, caustic the language really became, toxic for that matter. For example, here are just a few of the words and phrases from yesterday's journal. Root cause of financial crisis, mortgage crisis, avoiding foreclosing, Las Vegas defaults, investors even more wary. Two dreadful words at GM. GM down 42% in past 3 months. You don't even have to read past two or three lines to see this very, very negative tonality in almost all media print. So not only, frankly, do we have substantial negative economic news, the media headlines contribute in some measure to the self-fulfilling prophecy of recession. All right, let's step back for just a moment and let's at least define what in the world economically recession really means. Broadly speaking, recession is defined as a period of negative economic growth, usually accompanied by rising unemployment. More specifically, recession is often defined as two consecutive quarters of falling gross domestic product, falling GDP. Now, of course, gross domestic product, or GDP, is a measure of the overall economic activity in a country. It's calculated by adding the total value of a country's annual output of goods and services. In effect, GDP consists of really the sum of four different economic indicators. One, consumer, or what we'll call private spending. Two, business investment. Three, public or sort of government spending. And four, our net exports minus our net imports. How big is GDP? Well, the World Bank reports that the 2006 U.S. GDP was somewhere in excess of $13.2 trillion. That's really a pretty large number. And let me give you some examples of the other leading economies in the world in comparison of their size to the U.S. For example, the second largest GDP economy in the world is Japan. We're at $13.2 trillion. Japan, according to the World Bank, about $4.3 trillion. All right? That's less than one-third the size of the U.S. economy. Germany, next in line, $3 trillion. People's Republic of China, $2.7 trillion. The U.K., $2.3 trillion. France, $2.2 trillion, and so on and so on and so forth. India, about $1 trillion, according to the World Bank, based upon those statistics in 2006. All right? So, because of the greater independencies and interdependencies of world economies, we all know about that, it's often said when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world really catches a very bad cold, perhaps a virus or even a flu. Now, let's be honest. Consumer spending in the United States is contracting. Businesses are cutting back on investments, and we continue to import far more than we export as a nation. So three of the four major factors that make up GDP are moving negatively. All right? That's what's happening. So at the moment, while these three or four factors are moving negatively and are pointing downward, we're hearing all kinds of advice. We're hearing all kinds of stirring on Capitol Hill about stimulus packages. In other words, let's rebate some tax money, put it back in the hands of the middle class and the lower middle class so they can spend it. Now, what kinds of stimulus package are we talking about? Well, we've heard numbers as high as $100 billion. Now, $100 billion, well, it sounds like a lot of money. Compared to $13.2 trillion, it's not even 1% of our overall GDP. And here's something very interesting, and I'm going to talk about this in just a moment. Through yesterday's stock market close, all right, just basically, we're talking about 17 days of January. Stocks, whether you own U.S. stocks, whether you own big stocks, little stocks, mid-cap stocks, international stocks, emerging market stocks, it didn't matter. Stocks are broadly down, not only in the U.S., around the world, about 10%. I'll give you the exact numbers in just a couple of minutes. About 10%. All right? So if we look at a typical shareholder in the United States and we look at market capitalization of the U.S. stock markets, call it $15 trillion, all right? And you take a haircut of 10%. 10% of $15 trillion is a diminution of wealth of $1.5 trillion. That's a big number. That's going to make consumers even more wary, more disconcerted, more likely to cut back on spending. All of these things are coalescing, if you will, to create sort of a perfect storm. So the bottom line is that the average American is already feeling lots of economic pain, regardless of whether we are technically or non-technically in a recession. That economic pain, no question, is being felt at the gas pump. That's no surprise. And especially in the food market. Even I am shocked when I'm paying $3.50 for a loaf of wheat bread. It's just almost incredible. And we all know that story when we walk into the grocery market. So Wall Street, in my view, has already weighed in. They've already said we've got broadly lower stock market prices, literally across all major asset classes. So, for example, through yesterday's close, The S&P 500 is down 9.13% for the year. What about international indexes? Usually safe havens, they behave differently than the U.S. The total international index down 9.4% for the year. What about emerging markets? What about India, China, etc.? All of those emerging markets around the world, aren't they holding up? Don't they act differently than the United States? Through yesterday's close, down 10% for the year. So here's the bottom line. When we even talk about my own couch potato portfolio, oh my goodness, we are down 9.95% through the first 17 trading days of the stock market year. That's a big hit, ladies and gentlemen. There's no question about it. And where does it go from here? Well, we're certainly not sure. But what Wall Street is essentially telling us, they're telling us that we are already in significantly poor and downward economic times. Remember that the stock market is a predictor. They're predicting something that's going to happen 6 months from now. That's what the stock market is telling us. So, and it's very, very tough to bet against the stock market. Very, very tough. So whether we're in this recession, I guess what we're going to have to wait to hear are the first calendar quarter of the 2008 economic numbers and the second calendar quarter to determine whether or not technically we're in a recession. But the people have already spoken. The stock market has already spoken. So there you have it, David, just kind of a brief overview of where we are. You know I'm not a prognosticator. We do know a couple of things. We know that Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve are going to be meeting, either perhaps even today, we're not sure, or certainly by the end of next week, and we're going to see lower interest rates, right? We're seeing Treasury rates, the 10-year Treasury, below 4%. The positive news there is that if you are a purchaser of real estate, if you are going to buy, it's a great time to procure a mortgage. Because now we're looking at 15 and 30-year rates well into the lower fives, 5.5, 5.75, and probably will go lower from here. So that is somewhat of a positive lining. And of course, $100 billion talked about in Capitol Hill, I'm not certain that that's going to make a real big difference when we're already talking about a consumer haircut of $1.5 trillion just in the stock market in the first 17, 18 days of the year. So there you have it, David.
All right. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here to do this program and take questions about personal finance. We have callers ready to go. The lines are full. We will get to everybody here. But again, callers will help us by trying to be brief. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone in St. Joe, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Based upon the way things are going down, it appears to be a good time to put some money in the market, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly appears to be a period of time where one could dollar cost average into the market. And I've had a number of calls from my own clients and just literally scores of clients, calls from others. And what I can suggest, again, is we have to look at our overall asset allocation. What percent of your assets do you feel comfortable with in equities? What percent do you feel comfortable with in fixed income? And if you do have money sitting on the sidelines, no one knows where the bottom is of this market. Small companies have already dropped 20% from their highs. That's sort of a technical bear market. And a number of asset classes are not far behind. So the bottom line is, if you have money on the sidelines, maybe 10 or 15% of your money, you could go ahead and start dollar cost averaging perhaps a sixth of that money each month over the next 6 months. And I think probably looking back in 2 or 3 years, you'd be a happy camper.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. the other reason I called is because last month you talked about living trust. And
yes.
So after that discussion and hearing you, the glowing remarks, I got a couple books on trust, and one book, quote, says, "The best alternative to probate is a living trust. It avoids the problems of a will in probate and avoids problems associated with joint tenancy." So I thought, now I guess he knows what he's talking about. But as I was reading some of these books, I had a couple thoughts, and one is, it's talking about avoiding probate and that type of thing, and it also talks about some alternatives such as joint trust with right of survivorship. And I thought, well, that's fine. So what if, like, my wife and I have accounts with joint tenancy? I thought, well, what would preclude us from, well, first, if one of us dies, the surviving spouse changed the account from the deceased spouse's name to, say, a child's name to keep it in joint tenancy.
Well, number one, hang on just 1 second. The moment you have a joint asset with your spouse and one of you passes away, then by operation of law, automatically, instantaneously, that asset is now in the hands of the other spouse. It's okay. Titled in the hands of the other spouse.
Right.
So now it's in the hands of the other spouse. There would be no estate tax because of a marital deduction.
Right.
And now you could take that asset and you could jointly title it. But the moment you jointly title it with a child, you have essentially conveyed 50% of it to that child, which is a gift. And now you have to file a gift tax return. If the amount that you have conveyed is in excess of the annual gift tax exclusion, which is $12,000.
Oh, my.
That's okay. The rub.
That's the rub.
Okay.
Okay. And the other thing is, it's talking about avoiding probate and having accounts, joint tenancy. And since we have our mutual funds and money market fund and jointly owned, would that not have them cause them to avoid probate?
Absolutely. Anything held in joint tenancy with rights of survivorship bypasses probate. Any asset that you own, like a life insurance policy, like a 401k, like an IRA, that names a beneficiary by contract avoids probate. Only things titled in your own name.
Right.
That would be subject to probate.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And line number two is next, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Like everybody else, I have a little bit of a cold. So, last session, you mentioned in terms of the money market, I think that you didn't think it was a good idea maybe to move money out of the money market, right, over the long run or short run or whatever.
Well, no, what I was saying last month is I wanted everyone to check the quality of their money market.
Okay.
Because a lot of money markets that claim they have all AAA instruments in them, like treasuries, often do not. And in fact, this is quite interesting that you brought this up, because in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, there was an article that the Securities and Exchange Commission has sent written inquiries to some of the largest mutual fund companies in the country, inquiring about, one, what is exactly in those money market mutual funds, what are those assets, and two, how are you pricing those assets? So they're asking for much more specific, dispositive information, and that's just one more indication to me that if you have substantial assets in a money market fund, they should be housed very comfortably and very safely in a U.S. Treasury money market fund. That all of the instruments in that money market fund basically are Treasury bills, okay, backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And in that manner, we don't have to worry about a dollar-for-dollar drop in value of a mutual fund, because one share is always a buck. It's a dollar. I'd hate to wake up one morning and find out that my money market fund was no longer a dollar per share. It was 96 cents a share or 95 cents a share. That's because some of these money market funds indirectly may still have exposure to collateralized debt obligations and indirectly to subprime mortgages.
Would you know, I'm in TIAA and CREFT. I guess I'd have to call and find out.
You would have to call, and what you probably can do is even go to the website, and each quarter, most mutual fund companies will put on their website exactly their holdings. As opposed to sending you that quarterly report in the mail, it generally can be accessed on the website. If not, Be certain to talk to a retirement representative and ask specifically for the updated information on what is being held in those markets.
Would you also put some money into the inflation-linked bonds or not?
Well, I'm just simply saying that that certainly is one place that you could house money. Again, these are inflation bonds, and if you believe that we are going to see massive levels of inflation over the next 2 to 5 years, that certainly is a good bet with maybe 5 or 10% of your fixed income money.
Your couch potato, can we just quickly? Well, the one that's up there is for December 20th.
Well, that's right, and I did make an asset allocation change, as I mentioned, in December, effective January 1, and I think I have the numbers with me today, and that should be posted in the next couple of days, in the next 48 hours. But essentially, some of the asset allocation percentages changed. Mm-hmm. Essentially, in the olden days, U.S. small cap value had 16.5%. I moved that down to 10%, and I increased S&P 500 from 10 to 15%, and then the difference went into total international index. So I slightly changed the allocation up for S&P 500, up for total international index, and down for U.S. small cap value.
But in terms of decimal points, I guess it's sort of I have an old one, and I have this recent one. Does it? In other words, on S&P have 0.0048. So should that be moved three over? That was actually 4%?
Yeah, that was actually well, it was actually 4.8%, but you only had 10% of your money at 4.8%. You understand?
No, I know that.
Yeah.
But usually on some of them that you have in the couch potato, you move the decimal point to the percentage is what.
Right. These are expressed in decimals.
In decimals, okay.
Right. So you would have to add up all the decimals to get the total.
So year in, does it stay about the same? Because the last you had this updated was December 20th. So about
It dropped a little bit because over those last few days we had a little bit of a drop. Not a lot, but a little bit. But it was positive for the year.
Could you put both on? Because I'm trying to compare, you know, I'm doing retrospect sort of reflection on last year. Is there any way to sort of the update maybe have two? For last year?
Yeah, well, what you can do is you can go to the Vanguard website.
Okay.
Go to Vanguard website, click on mutual funds, click on index funds only, and then you can look at all of those returns, the one-year, three-year, five-year returns.
Okay, great.
Okay?
Thanks a lot.
A pleasure.
Thank you. We're at our midpoint here. It's our monthly program on personal finance. David Sino is the guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. He's here once a month. We do this show to try to give you some help and advice when it comes to financial planning. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign, and this is line number three. Hello.
Hello. Maybe I shouldn't mention any names, but I'm sure you're aware that an old regional brokerage firm was recently taken over by a very large bank. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on the implications, possible implications of that for people who have accounts with the brokerage firm.
Well, I think what you want to do is make certain that the company that takes them over is of high quality. I really don't have a lot of concern about this particular one that you're referring to. And remember that the brokerage account still has SIPC insurance. I wouldn't have a lot of just cash laying around, however. As long as you are denominated in actual securities, then I don't think you have any kind of problem.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. My pleasure.
Next is Bloomington, Indiana, line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. About the subprime loan problem and especially about what motivated these loans, first question. I know we have low interest rates, but what motivated loan officers at major banks and throughout the banking industry, these loan officers made imprudent loans? Why? Why throughout the banking industry would loan officers make imprudent loans?
Well, first of all, most of the loans that we're talking about when we talk about subprime loans are residential loans. That's number one.
Mortgages?
Yes.
Yeah.
Residential mortgages. Number two, if you check on the compensation package, what you will find out is that everybody in the chain, from the mortgage broker to the underwriters. Everyone got a piece of the action. There's a wonderful story in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about how in the world did this happen. And the Wall Street Journal sort of sums it up as greed. There was lots and lots of easy money that was available. And as a result of all of the easy money that was washing around in the economy, underwriting standards became very, very lax. And there was an incentive among brokers, among all the players in the system, to make unwise mortgages.
And you blame the Federal Reserve. When the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates, that produced the easy money, didn't it?
Well, it produced easy money, but what really happened is that banks got very, very, lazy about their underwriting standards because they saw easy money. And remember that all of these loans, you made all of your money up front. So these financial institutions made these loans and then they sold them in the secondary market to unsuspecting buyers. Well, let's call it unsophisticated buyers.
Why were these buyers unsophisticated? They were selling these loan contracts to supposedly other financial institutions.
Yes.
These other financial institutions are supposed to be run by wise professionals.
That's right.
They weren't very wise.
They weren't very wise because they saw easy money and they were making loans to people who never deserved to make a loan at very high interest rates.
And now places like Citigroup and lately Merrill Lynch are taking billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in write-downs.
Because they underwrote huge baskets of these loans and then sold these loans off in slivers, but they kept some of those slivers in their own inventory. And those slivers that they kept in their own inventory to the tune of billions of dollars turned out to be very problematic and had to be written down dramatically.
Well, I tell you, I have lost a lot of respect for these so-called wise professionals. This situation has really made me lose respect for these guys.
Well, it's the old story. Sometimes the best research and the best analysis is done by good old number one, yourself.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Good answer.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to another caller here back where we are. This is Champagne, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi, is this me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think this is a second level of follow-up to a question you've already answered, but I need it at the Investing for Dummies level of answer to know exactly what you mean. I did listen last month about your recommendation to exit national money market funds and purchase Treasury money market funds.
Which are also national money market funds.
So I tried to find out what you meant by that. We're invested in Fidelity and Vanguard. And in the annual reports, I did see what you are talking about in terms of exposure to what the fund is exposed to. The only one I found that was 100% Treasuries was the Vanguard Inflation Protected Securities.
Actually, the Vanguard U.S. Treasury Trust money market is 99.9% T-bills.
Vanguard
U.S. Treasury Trust.
Treasury
Trust money market.
Trust money market.
Mm-hmm. Is 99.9% Treasuries.
And we're conservative investors with, over half in cash or money markets.
Sure.
Is this a fund that could absorb something like that?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Can it be held in a 403B?
Can it be held in a 403B if Vanguard is offered as part of that 403B?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then the answer is yes.
And Roth or anything like
Yes, absolutely.
So Vanguard U.S. Treasury. And also you said some exposure to bank money market money funds are okay.
As long as you are directly at a bank. So if you are at a local bank, remember they are FDIC insured. So if you have $100,000 or less, you're in pretty safe territory with reference to having a money market account at a bank. And while I utilize national money market accounts, I also use local bank money market accounts. Often they actually pay a higher interest rate than national accounts. And it's just a good idea because you are investing back in your own community.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And where we'll go next, we'll go to Urbana. And that would be line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
David, the last month when you were on the program, you said something about do not put your IRA into your trust. Is that right? And if that's right, would you explain that, please?
Well, first of all, an IRA, what I was talking about last month as an individual retirement account, that individual retirement account is yours. Now, with an individual retirement account, you name a beneficiary of that individual retirement account. Often for people who are married, they would name their spouse. If they are not married, perhaps divorced, widowed, etc., and they have surviving children, they name their children as the primary beneficiary. For people who don't have children, maybe don't have a spouse, then they may indeed name some other entity as their beneficiary. Maybe it's a charity. So lots of people, for example, might name the U of I Foundation as the beneficiary of an IRA. Alternatively, some people utilize a trust. And that is to say that the beneficiary is actually the trust, and then the trustee of the trust basically follows whatever is designated in that trust.
So but you have to be. You can put it in the trust.
I'm saying that the proceeds from an IRA can be. The beneficiary can be a trust. That is correct. Usually people don't do that because there are certain income tax consequences which may work against the ultimate beneficiaries of the trust. So you have to work with a tax attorney and an estate planner who understands those rules because there's two parts to it. One is naming a trust as a beneficiary, and then what does that trust say? Who are the beneficiaries of the trust? And there is an income tax consequence that can be negative depending upon what that trust document says.
Okay, so you have to, first of all, you name the trust as a beneficiary, and then you name the beneficiaries of the trust. Is that
absolutely
right?
That's correct, because you have a trust document that already names a trustee to administer the trust, and you have beneficiaries of the trust.
Okay, well, thank you.
My pleasure.
And again, we go on to the next caller, and that would be someone who is in Champaign, line number three. Hello.
Hi, yes, this is me?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I have some rental property, real estate, that from which I draw, you know, a rental income. And, you know, it does reasonably well. I mean, I cover the cost of maintenance and so on and draw a little profit from it. But the situation, my situation is such, without getting into the details, that within probably, I would say, a three-year horizon, I'm going to have to sell this property to generate, you know, some liquid assets. And so my question is simply this. I mean, would you recommend, you know, maybe selling sooner rather than later, like now, this spring, for instance, and take advantage of some of the value that perhaps might be out there in the stock market, the mutual fund market now that prices have dropped, or would you recommend holding on to this real estate for as long as I can before I will have to liquidate it?
Well, let me ask you some questions. Is this is this quality real estate? Is this good real estate?
Well
located, good income stream, and you're amortizing a mortgage.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
Yes, to all three.
All right. And are you overweighted in real estate in terms of your overall portfolio?
It depends on what you mean by overweighted.
Well, if you took all of your assets, are you 80 or 90% in real estate?
I'll have to think about that. Not including my 401k retirement plan.
Okay.
Not there.
All right. So remember, you have to look at your assets in their totality.
Right.
And it may turn out that on that basis, you are not overweighted necessarily in real estate. I think if you've got a good piece of real estate, you're actually having a positive cash flow from it. It is not burdensome. You are amortizing a loan. My proclivity and my predilection would be to hold on to it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I feel kind of dumb, but I'm one of these, you know, folks who need to read Investment for Dummies. But when you say amortize, I mean, could you just define that briefly?
Well, it simply means that you are continuing to pay down every month. Sure. There's sufficient cash flow to pay down every month on the mortgage that's required.
Uh-huh.
You're paying it off every month, and you're building equity. You're building principal. Right?
Yeah, that,
so if that's really the case and you still have some positive cash flow, then I probably would hang on to that property. The other thing that you might consider as interest rates, if indeed they continue to drop, you might look at refinancing, right? And refinancing up to a level where you still have the cash flow from the property to pay the mortgage payment, the taxes, the insurance, and amortize the deal. So as opposed to selling and recognizing a capital gain, even 3 years from now, you may be in a position, if some real estate goes up, it recovers, whatever, to actually refinance and tax-free take cash out of the property and still own it. Don't discount that possibility.
Right. And you know, that's you're looking at maybe what anywhere from a $300 to $600 or $800 cost at something like that, refinance.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, one time.
Maybe $1,000 cost to refinance. Oh. But the point is that if you have sufficient equity in 3 years, you might be able to unlock that equity. You might be better off to unlock the equity, hang on to the property, not impact yourself tax-wise, and continue to own rental property.
I see. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, we'll continue talking with people who have questions. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus with David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is Potomac, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to return to the topic of the IRA. And now, when a spouse dies, then the IRA goes to the surviving spouse without a tax penalty. And then I remember seeing something that said that there is a new rule about adding a child's name to an IRA and letting it flow to them when a mother or father passes.
Well, yes.
Is that rule still in effect?
Yes. Well, what really happens is, let's say, husband and wife, married for a long time, husband passes away, husband has an IRA.
Mm-hmm.
The wife is generally designated as the beneficiary of that IRA. She's the primary beneficiary. Also in an IRA, we usually name contingent beneficiaries. And that is if the primary beneficiary predeceases the holder of the IRA and then the holder of the IRA passes away, then the IRA would go to the contingent beneficiaries. But in the circumstances and in the fact pattern that you enumerate, essentially that IRA becomes what is referred to as a spousal IRA. It's a tax-free rollover, and now it's yours. It's a spousal IRA. Once you have it, then you also name a beneficiary. So in the event of your death, then that IRA is going to pass to a named beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that works.
Okay, so there wouldn't be any tax penalty then to that beneficiary?
Well, the ultimate beneficiary will have some options of how that money comes out. And there are a number of complex rules, but in any event, when that ultimate beneficiary takes the money out, if it was a traditional IRA, in other words, a tax-deferred IRA, the money that will come out of it will be subject to taxable income. There are certain circumstances, however, where the ultimate beneficiary may be able to take the money over the life expectancy of that beneficiary. And those are some additional complex rules, and you would have to consult your accountant to make certain that your particular IRA is set up and has been utilized in such a way so that a beneficiary can take advantage of those particular rules. But bottom line is ultimately when money comes out of an IRA, it's going to at least be subject to federal income tax if it's a traditional IRA, and that is that it grew tax deferred and people took a tax deduction originally for putting money into their IRA.
Are different for the Roth IRA.
Yes, the rules are different for a Roth IRA because that is after-tax money. The money grows tax-free, and if you follow the rules, there is no income tax impact, but it is still part of one's estate, so that ultimately when one passes away, if one had a very large estate, including a Roth IRA, there could be an estate tax issue. But that's for folks with net worths in excess of a couple of million dollars.
Okay. We're safely under that. Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And let's see where we'll go next. I believe that would be line number two and a listener in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the advisability of investing a portion of the bond part of one's portfolio in inflation-protected security fund, such as that of Vanguard. First of all, is that a smart idea? And secondly, if it is, should it be held inside or outside of an IRA, or does that matter?
Well, it depends on how you are allocated. Interestingly enough, if you believe that interest rates are going to continue to trend down, as it appears, one of the very few safe havens recently, certainly over the last 60 days, have been intermediate and long-term bond funds because they hold higher coupons. And as a result, when interest rates go down in the economy because of the inverse relationship between direction of bonds and interest rates, those bonds have gone up.
Right.
And as a result, your bond portfolio has gone up. If you believe that we are going to see massive inflation, or not even massive, but substantial inflation, and an awful lot of folks think we are, as a result of even lowering interest rates, we're just putting off this massive inflation down the road, then it seems to me that a percentage of your bond portfolio could be safely ensconced in these inflation-protected securities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
And as you know, the way these inflation-protected securities work, they have an interest rate, which is very low, that they pay, but then they accrue at these inflationary rates.
Right.
And I think they're certainly a perfectly appropriate place to hold those inside a tax-deferred investment.
Okay.
So if you have a Roth, if you have an IRA, if you have a 403B, whatever, that would be a perfectly appropriate place to hold that kind of investment.
What about holding them outside of a tax-deferred investment?
Well, I think that because of some of the tax ramifications, I think you're better off inside.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you. And next we'll go to Belgium, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
How are you?
Oh, just fine. Yourselves?
Very good. Thank you.
Plenty cold enough today.
It certainly is.
I have an observation and a question for you. The observation is that a few years ago, banks made a tremendous amount of money on these investments and were doing very, very well. And now they've, for the risk they've taken, now they have to pay the price. And it seems though we are giving them an easy way out. But of course, that means we have to take care of ourselves too. I understand that. And so I just don't really feel too sorry for the banks. But the point I'd really like to get to and ask you a question about it, I'd like you to consider United States after World War II, how we got a lot of money by taking care of the rest of the world with worldly goods and providing it for them. And today, after this war we have, and the oil-producing countries taking all of our money now, we took the money from England and Europe to make them whole again, and now the oil-rich countries are taking it from us to make us whole again, or what we think is whole again. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, it's very, very concerning. What we're seeing is, because of the export-import situation, as you quite rightly point out, huge numbers of dollars are ending up in other countries. That's a huge problem. And these dollars are finding their way into what are called sovereign nation funds. And we don't understand these sovereign nation funds very well. And whether it's Korea, whether it is China, whether it is a number of the consortium of the Arab countries. The bottom line is that massive amounts of capital are being moved back into our markets to bail out some of the classic, most well-known, some of the jewels of the U.S. stock market. When we see stock market investments in Citicorp, Merrill Lynch, to the tune of billions of dollars by these sovereign nation funds, and make no mistake about it, these sovereign nation funds probably have in total somewhere between a half a trillion and perhaps as much as $2 trillion sitting on the sidelines waiting to invest in our former trophy properties, trophy equities, trophy real estate, trophy buildings all across America. Now, there are times when we need this capital, and this is one of the times that we need capital. America does not have the capital on hand, and we are searching this out from foreign countries. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily. What concerns me more than anything is not the actual infusion of the money into these various assets, be they stocks, securities, bonds, whatever they may be. What concerns me is the political ramifications and what kind of political influence ultimately these sovereign nation funds will have over our finances, over our community. It's sort of like America is on sale. We have to face facts. We look at our currency relative to the yen. We look at our currency relative to the euro. My goodness, does anybody go to England anymore? I'm not sure, when we're paying at least two and a quarter for a dollar. It's just ridiculous. So we've got the perfect storm. We've got a situation where other countries have massive amounts of capital and can invest inexpensively in the U.S., and the more they invest, the more influence they will wield. So my biggest concern is the political influence, not even so much the economic influence.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, and let's see. We'll talk now with someone in Champaign, and this is line number three. Hello.
Hi. Well, from a very macro level to a micro level for me.
Terrific.
You know, we bought our house almost six years ago, and about a year after that, we refinanced. 15-year mortgage, about around 6.5% or less than that. And so we basically built up equity. We probably owe maybe 60% now on the house.
Okay.
Wondered if with the interest rates going lower now about refinancing and not so much taking the money that we've accumulated and doing something with it, you know, to inject more in the economy. We don't really want to do that. But what we want to do is just lower our payments so that then we can, whatever we have left over from, you know, have a little bit more discretionary income so we can invest that money in other things. So I don't know if that's something that is prudent to do or if it's something that even banks would want to do.
Well, I think that's called right thinking. That's what I call that, is right thinking. People, when they refinance, make a major mistake. They take money out, and then they go spend it. I like the idea of no money out. That's a very, very inexpensive refinance. And I think what you have to do is simply look at the numbers. You've got to shop and go again for a 15-year mortgage.
Okay.
All right? Look at a 15-year rate. Should be somewhere in the mid-fives or the lower fives.
Okay.
If you really shop. And see what that difference would be in your monthly payment. And in addition, see what the period of time it takes to pay back the refinancing costs. In other words, if you're going to...
Oh, the fees and all that.
That's correct. In other words, if you're going to incur $1,000 of fees,
okay,
but your mortgage payment drops $100, $150 a month, what's the payback time?
Right.
And if you can pay yourself back in somewhere between 6 and 12 months, and you know you are not going to move, you're going to stay in your house, that's a winner.
Okay, so for stay in the house for, say, at least another 2 to 3 years?
At least, sure.
To recover the fees?
Sure, sure.
Okay, so that would be the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what we would plan to do.
Yeah.
Now, the only other question has to do with, I just kind of came in when you were talking about national money markets versus local money and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
We've had money market fund with, well, it was Ameriprise, it was American Express and,
mm-hmm, sure,
and all that stuff. It's been there for a long time. We don't really pay a lot of attention to it, and been wondering, should we, you know, bring that more local and...
Well, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that whatever money market you're in, you want to find out what are the quality of assets underlying that money market.
Okay.
And as I've said before, I feel much more comfortable today in money markets that are basically treasury bill-backed money markets, or in the alternative, be in a local community money market at a local bank, which might pay the higher interest rate than even a national money market,
right,
so long as it's FDIC insured up to $100,000.
Okay, yeah, and that's what we haven't looked at, is what the rates are paying back. Okay.
There you go.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
All right, and we'll try and get real. Well, that caller gave up on us. Maybe let me ask you one question. We have now people in Washington, D.C. talking about economic stimulus packages, and one of the things that it sounds like the president's going to say is, we're going to give you a rebate. We're going to write everybody, every American, we're going to write you a check in the hope that then you will take that money out and spend it. When this happened before, I seem to recall, actually, that didn't happen. People were not feeling confident, and they just took the money and they stuck it in the bank.
And they put it in a savings account, didn't they? They didn't spend it.
They didn't spend it.
That's correct.
Does anybody think that now things are going to be any different? Is everybody going to take their check and go out and buy a big screen TV? And even if they did, what sort of difference would that make?
Well, David, you've hit the hammer on the head. First of all, $100 billion stimulus package over a period of time, is that really going to have an impact? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so when we just watched $1.5 trillion of net worth disappear. By the way, I know we don't have time, but there was an amazing article in Thursday's Wall Street Journal entitled Deal Fees Under Fire Amid Mortgage Crisis. Guaranteed rewards to bankers, middlemen are in the spotlight and one of the major causes for this mortgage debacle. It's a great article on precisely how did this happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Dave will be back next month. Dave Zeno is clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.